Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're here for oral argument in Michael David Carruth versus the Commissioner of the Alabama Department of Corrections. Thomas Martell Gogans is here for Carruth. Robert Overing is here for the Commissioner. And Mr. Gogans, you may begin your argument.
This afternoon, I'd like to talk about three different issues that we have raised in our brief. First being jurors' premature deliberations on the case. The second being prosecution argument and ineffective assistance of counsel on appeal. And the third being the failure of a handoff after the decision of the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals. Turning to the first issue, we have contended that the jurors improperly started talking about the case before they were supposed to. The Alabama courts, in our view, made an unreasonable determination of the facts. The state trial court statement was this: no juror testified that discussions concerning petitioner's guilt or possible sentence were ever made or heard until the case was turned over to the jury to begin deliberations after being properly instructed. I don't think the record supports that finding at all. There were three jurors who were called to testify at the state Rule 32 hearing. The first one, I didn't write down the names, I'm just gonna call this juror number one, said that she didn't recall any discussion about the case. She said that she didn't recall discussion at either the hotel, whether it was sequestered, or at the courthouse during the course of the trial.
Is there anything in the record that reflects that any of the jurors came to any sort of conclusion about the guilt or innocence of Carruth during these, when these comments took place?
As far as a collective, let me just say this. I believe that the juror Horn had said, let me turn to his real quick, but I think he did make a statement that indicated that there were some discussions where they're talking about evidence and what it showed. Comments at times. First, he said he didn't remember anybody saying he was innocent or whether he was guilty without any doubt. But then he went on to say that it had been a while. He had previously, he said they might have mentioned a piece of evidence, talking about stuff being shocking. Jurors saying he can't believe the amount of evidence because there was just a lot of evidence. He had previously made a statement, a written statement. He had gone through it, made 40 or so different changes in it. That was admitted not for substantive evidence, but
that's J.H., that's juror J.H., but then at the evidentiary hearing, I thought he testified that, these were just some passing comments where someone may have said, I can't believe they were going to show us the video or a picture of the body, and none of the jurors expressed any opinion about the guilt or the innocence of the defendant in this case, number one and number two. The other problem that I see with your argument is there's nothing that came in that was external. These were just comments made by the jurors themselves. And I'm not aware that the Supreme Court or any other court has held that a juror's opinion is extrinsic evidence, that might be presumptively prejudicial.
Well,
how do you get around that?
Well,
what's your best case?
I think the best case is I've not ever seen this other than this case. In my 40 years, I haven't seen a case with jurors actually discussing the case, or at least finding out about discussing the case beforehand. But I think as far as an external source, like a third party out in the hall, somebody calls them up, there's not any evidence of this in this case, but my position would be it shouldn't make any difference whether it's the juror talking before they're supposed to be talking about it, and whether it is a third party. Either way, you have, let's say there's one person that's doing this, you have one person who's injecting that opinion and that suggestion to the other 12
but there's no,
out of the time
there's no
it's supposed to happen.
There's no opinion, though. As I see in this record, there's no opinion. Then jurors just sort of like commented, asked, they showed us a picture of the body. They showed, is there anything that reflects an opinion by one of the jurors about the defendant's guilt or innocence?
The statement that Juror Horn had made before that, that was admitted for impeachment, I think it really should have been.
Yeah, he backed off of that. He backed off of that, didn't he?
Sir?
Didn't he back off of that?
Initially he had said that he didn't recall it. And then when he was shown the statement, he admitted he had read the statement. He had made a lot of changes in it. He had signed the statement. And in his statement, he said, we talked about what evidence made Michael Carruth guilty of capital murder. That, to me, is getting to the ultimate issue in the guilt-innocence phase.
But you've cited to two cases. You've cited to Remmer. You've cited to Irvin. And you've just now, during our oral argument, you've said you don't see why we should see that there's a difference between a third party having contact with the jurors and the jurors starting deliberations early. But sure, and the cases that you're citing are dealing with external influences on the jury. But surely you can see that those are radically different things, to have an external influence on a juror, which is not proper under any circumstances, and jurors having conversations amongst themselves when they are going to be deliberating, in fact, later.
I agree that it is different. I don't know that I would go so far as to say it's radically different. I think if you take the thought process behind the two cases where you have, you don't want an external influence on it, and you want a jury that is impartial, I'm not sure what difference it would make whether the influence comes from within the jury box because somebody is talking about it, suggesting opinions before that's supposed to be done, or whether or not it's somebody that's out in the hallway. It's kind of like you've got two over here and two over here, and our position is, well, add it up to four. It's a lot, to us, a logical extension of it. And I think that that was not...
It's a logical extension that you're arguing for, but there's no case law suggesting support for that extension.
There's not a Supreme Court case that talks about the same spotted dog with three legs. That's correct. But I think that it is a lot. If you read both of the Remmer and Irwin, I think that would flow from that. That would be an extension which should have been extended in this case.
Well, I'm not sure that you can see in reading those cases that this extension would flow from it. That's what you're arguing for.
Another thing, too, when Juror CT was testifying at the Rule 32 hearing, she said that everybody was disturbed over the evidence. And the question I would have would be, how would you know they're disturbed about the evidence unless they're talking about the evidence?
Well, I think they have acknowledged, the jurors who had testified, they had acknowledged that they might make a passing comment like, we never thought we were going to see a photo of a dead body. I mean, there were things like that. They've acknowledged that, right?
Yes, ma'am. And she acknowledged in her testimony that during the break that they did talk about the evidence in the case, which was, of course, contrary to the trial court's instructions, which, you know, in every case. No juror, as far as I can tell, you'd be hard-pressed to find a juror that would want to come into court and say, well, I know the judge told me to do it, but I did it anyway. So I think when you at least get them saying, yeah, we talked about it, I think it's a fair conclusion that they were talking about the evidence and what it meant before they had heard all of the evidence, before they had been instructed by the court, before they had heard any arguments of counsel. Turning to the next issue I'd like to address this afternoon has to do with the an argument, and it was a fairly short period of time during the overall closing argument. And it appears to us that the prosecutor had injected the issue of punishment into the guilt phase argument. Judge Watkins in district court said that was disconcerting to have any mention of punishment in the guilt innocence phase, and it noted that the trial court had not instructed the jury not to, he did not direct the jury to ignore punishment in the decision making.
But this was already a capital qualified jury, right?
It is. But the problem that we have with it is this. I'm no Latin scholar, not even a former Latin student, but I've read there's a term called, if I pronounce this somewhat correctly, praetoritio, which if the speaker asserts a proposition by denying that it should be invoked. In this case, what he had done was, in closing argument, and again, it's like, you know, a couple of sentences in his closing argument, but I think it's important. He said, I'm going to ask you to convict the man of these capital counts, the only punishments for which are life without parole or the death penalty, something you're not even considering now. But if you convict him of those capital counts, we'll get to that later.
Well, it was improper, but there was an objection.
There was.
So how can counsel be ineffective if he objected?
Well, we're saying appellate counsel was ineffective for not raising that on direct appeal. That's our contention here. Trial counsel did object to it. There's a discussion with the trial judge. Trial judge said noted, but it was not raised on direct appeal.
And so if counsel on appeal was ineffective for failing to raise that issue on appeal, the second prong of Strickland versus Washington requires that you establish prejudice. How do you get around the prejudice given this horrific nature of this case? You got to show that he was prejudiced by this failure.
I think if I were talking about an argument that related to, say, a particular item of evidence, that might be different. But here, the injection of punishment, for example, you know, you mentioned, look, we got some bad facts in this case, and I think this could be read as the prosecutor is thinking, I got some bad facts here. They're going to want to punish somebody, and the only way they're going to get to do it is to find him guilty. So the suggestion of it puts in the juror's mind, the only way we can get to do this is to find this guy guilty. And as far as, in Alabama, the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals had said,
what if the evidence of guilt is overwhelming, though?
I'm sorry?
If the evidence of guilt is overwhelming. And that's what the commissioner is arguing. And so you've got to, in order to show prejudice, you got to show, I think the case, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Donnelly versus DeCristofaro, that if what was done was improper, it has to so infect the trial with unfairness to significantly deny the defendant due process.
Well, our position is just suggesting to a jury, the only way you're going to get to do this is to find him guilty. That should be enough, even if the evidence is overwhelming. The criminal appeals had criticized because we didn't have anything to show, well, what effect did it have on the jurors? You didn't have anybody testify, but like federal court and state court, that's prohibited by rules of evidence to get into their mental operations. You can talk about, you know, who said what and things like that, but as far as the deliberation.
Didn't know what the punishment would be for this crime, this first degree murder, they might have found him not guilty. Is that what you're trying to convince us?
I think, in particularly a case with a younger decedent, I think the fear of many defense lawyers is, look, I got a young decedent here, I've got a young victim. The juror is going to want somebody to pay for this. And I think in this case, I think the fact that the deceased was only 12 years old, I think injecting the idea into the jury box, look, the only way you're going to get to do what I know you all want to do is to find him guilty of capital murder. Don't worry about felony murder or anything like that, because you can't do what I know you want to do unless you find him guilty. So I think in this context, I think that was, in and of itself, I think that was prejudicial, because it pretty much, if you want to do this, you've got to find him guilty.
So I had mentioned the fact that this was already a capital qualified jury, but also during Carruth's closing argument at trial, which is before the prosecutor's remarks, Carruth's own counsel stated to the jury that capital charges are a little bit different because it is the ultimate punishment, death. How, in light of that, and in light of the fact this is a capital qualified jury, how are you meeting the standard that Judge Wilson has just laid out, that this is, whether the prosecutor's argument so infected the trial with unfairness as to result in a denial of due process?
As a defense lawyer, I probably would not have said that, but I think in this instance, the fact that you have a district attorney saying it, where he's suggesting if you want to get there, you've got to find him guilty of this, which is different than what the defense lawyer had said. It wasn't a suggestion. If you want to get your dessert, you've got to eat all your food first.
But they're both mentioning it.
That's correct.
So if the defense lawyer has mentioned this is a capital case, punishment, death, then how can the prosecutor's following remarks have infected the trial?
I think, for one, because it's the prosecutor. Number two, the way it was worded is you can't do that unless you find him guilty of this. And then he followed it up, and we'll get to that later, suggesting you're going to get to do this, but first you've got to do what I ask you to do.
But at the same time, you're focusing on those prosecutor's words and how they're different from Carruth's counsel. The prosecutor did expressly tell the jury in that same challenge statement that they were not considering punishment yet, and only if they convicted Carruth would they get to the penalty phase later. How is that not a clarifying statement?
Well, taken just reading a transcript of it, I can see that line of thought, but my thought is it's a suggestion. It's like nobody considered this. You know, for example, if I have a case where the deceased was dealing drugs, it would be tantamount to me saying, "Well, I don't want you to consider that the deceased in this case was selling drugs and poisoning people and killing people and all that. That's not a consideration." That cat's already out of the bag, and the barn door is open on that point for the jury to consider that.
Also on this issue of whether it so infected the trial, there is overwhelming evidence against your client. I think that factors into the analysis here too. This isn't a close case on guilt.
I will agree there's a lot of evidence. However, I think just as a matter of process, it suggests, look, if you want to get to the penalty phase, you got to find him guilty. I think that in and of itself, I think, should warrant some relief. The third issue I want to address briefly is on the handoff. This was convoluted way things happened here is the Carruth's lawyer just moved, disappeared, did not notify Carruth that criminal appeals had ruled against him and that a certificate of judgment had issued, did not notify him. He only had a short period of time, 14 days, to file a cert petition with the Alabama Supreme Court. Our position is under the Roe versus Flores-Ortega, which does deal only with filing a notice of appeal. However, the Supreme Court says, look, if you're going to give somebody a right to appeal, you got to give them counsel. Well, in this case, Alabama has given people sentenced to death something beyond a denial of rehearing by the Alabama Court of Appeals. And it is the filing of a cert petition. Doesn't say it's got to be granted, but the lawyer has at least got to do it. The state has given the defendant that right. There seems to be a circuit. There is a to me, I think, a circuit split on this, but I think it flows from Roe. If you've got a right to something, you have a right to counsel there. You know, it's like in the 11th Circuit. I'm sure you see cases where somebody has pled guilty in district court. There's a plea agreement with an appeal waiver. The judge taking the plea has gone through all of the requirements of Rule 11, has discussed the appeal waiver with the defendant. There's an agreement for a bottom of the guideline sentence. The sentence is at the bottom of the guidelines or below. And then there's an appeal, and counsel's appointed for the appeal. Everybody, you know, pretty much knows, well, he's got a right to appeal, but nothing's going to happen here. It's the same thing. There's a right to counsel there, just as there is a right to effective counsel. At least file the cert petition. For example, in federal court, you still got to file the notice of appeal, even though everybody knows nothing may happen with it.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Overham.
May it please the court, Robert Overing for the state of Alabama. Kruth raises four possible grounds for relief in this appeal, and they can be rejected for various reasons, such as failure to exhaust, or because they would require an extension of clearly established federal law, or because they rely on evidence not in the record. But the one common thread through all of them is that there's no prejudice here. And for each of these claims, he's got to show that it would have changed the outcome if things had gone differently. He can't do that because Kruth is guilty. There was overwhelming evidence at trial, primarily from the father of the 12-year-old boy, Brett Bowyer, who was killed. The father himself was almost killed. He was slashed in the throat three times and buried alive, and he miraculously survived. He climbed out and was able to identify his killers. And everything in his story added up about the costume and disguise that Kruth wore, about the Crown Vic car, about the cash they stole, and the Kruth's blood and DNA were found on Butch's clothing. So the evidence was overwhelming here, and that led to a very clear conviction, a unanimous jury verdict, a unanimous verdict of the death sentence. The state proved four aggravators, and none of that is in question on this appeal. So for any of these issues, you have to ask, would it have made a difference? And the answer is no. First, on the premature jury deliberations claim, this claim, in order for the court to grant relief, Kruth asks to apply Remmer. But Remmer is not on all fours with this case, admittedly, and the reply brief says it would be an extension of Remmer to apply to internal jury deliberations. And I think I just heard counsel mention that there's no Supreme Court case that talks about exactly these facts. And when that's the case, AEDPA bars relief, because under 2254D, you have to show that the state decision was contrary to clearly established federal law as set forth by the Supreme Court. And if there is no case that deals with juror pre-deliberations, then it would be an extension of prior precedent, and it's not one that the state court can be held accountable for. Perhaps there should be a constitutional right against premature jury deliberations, but the Supreme Court hasn't said so, and so AEDPA bars relief. Remmer was about tampering. It was about external influences, and the Irvin case was about prejudice before the beginning of the trial, about pretrial publicity affecting the jury's opinion about the case before it even began. So neither of these is directly on point, and although it wasn't cited in our brief, I direct the court to the Supreme Court's decision in White versus Woodall in 2014, which analyzed the Williams case cited in the reply brief. And what White decided about extensions of federal law is that, quote, if a habeas court must extend a rationale before it can apply to the facts at hand, then by definition, the rationale was not clearly established. And so no extension of federal law can be held against the state court. There's also an argument that Remmer isn't even clearly established law to begin with. At least three justices in a recent case, Shoup versus Cunningham, wrote an opinion questioning whether Remmer even is a clearly established constitutional law that would apply to state courts. It was more a decision of federal rules of criminal procedure. But let's get to the facts. Even if this would not be an extension of law that would be barred by AEDPA, it was a reasonable determination for the state courts to decide that there weren't prejudicial pre-deliberations going on. And just last term, this court decided in Gavin versus the Commissioner of Alabama Department of Corrections that even when a jury had pre-decided, they had voted on the death penalty before the sentencing phase began, that did not rise to the level of a constitutional violation. So the burden here is extremely high to show that the jury did something untoward and that affected the outcome. In another case in this court, United States versus Dominguez, 226 F3rd 1235 from the year 2000, a juror asked the judge to be excused because a general consensus was forming against her point of view. During trial, a general consensus was forming, and this court said that that was not a ground for relief. So these types of passing comments that were made over a game of Rummy Cube don't rise to the level that would be required to grant relief, even if there were a Supreme Court case saying that such a claim is viable. There's some reliance, some attempt to make a factual dispute out of the Rummy Cube statement, Juror J.H.'s statement, which was admitted only for impeachment purposes. It was not admitted as substantive evidence, and so it wasn't part of the state record. And under AEDPA, if you're asking, was the state court decision unreasonable in light of the record, we have to look at properly admitted evidence as substantive evidence. And this was made just as a proffer, and then the juror made live testimony. And so the judge had an opportunity to hear the testimony, and the juror did backtrack to some degree from that statement, which appeared to be drafted by defense counsel. And if you read the statement, respectfully, it doesn't seem like something that an average Joe would say. It looks like something drafted by a lawyer. And so it was well within the discretion of the court to decide to prioritize the live testimony of that juror and two other jurors over the older Rummy Cube statement. The other two jurors either didn't remember that what went on at the hotel, or the one of them said, absolutely not. We did not talk about the guilt or innocence or the penalty back at the hotel. So there's just not enough evidence here to say, under AEDPA, that there's clear and convincing evidence to displace the state court's findings. I'll move on to the second argument about prosecutorial misconduct. The state maintains that this claim was not exhausted because Carruth did not argue it to any degree of thoroughness in the cert petition in post-conviction proceedings. Carruth just said the claim was, quote, meritorious, which if anyone did that before this court, the court would say it was abandoned because it wasn't developed. There was no assignment of error to the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals, and there's no citation to authority to show why the appellate court was wrong. So it wasn't argued through a complete round of state proceedings, and so it's not been exhausted and can't be a ground for federal habeas relief. But even if this court reaches the merits, it's a high bar. Under Donnelly, the error must have so infected the trial with unfairness as to make the resulting conviction a denial of due process. And beyond that, Carruth has to show prejudice, that there's a reasonable probability that absent the remark, Carruth would have been acquitted. And then, because this is—
Was it an improper statement by the prosecutor, though? We haven't reached the penalty phase yet. This is the guilt phase. It was an improper statement. In fact, when there was an objection, the trial judge said, noted. That suggests that it was improper. Improper argument by the prosecutor, doesn't it?
As a general matter, during the guilt phase, the prosecution should speak to guilt, and during the penalty phase, the prosecutor should speak to the penalty. But this was one line through the whole proceedings. It has to be viewed in the context of a days-long trial. And this court has said that an isolated remark like that, one line of the prosecutor's argument, must be viewed with lenity. It wasn't a focal point of the case. It wasn't brought up again and again throughout closing argument. It was one line in which he quickly cured it by saying, you're not considering that now, and we'll get to that phase later. And maybe that was a full cure, maybe it wasn't. But the question under EDPA is whether it's beyond fair-minded disagreement that this was ineffectiveness for failing to raise this argument on appeal. Now, I didn't hear...
It was an important argument that should have been raised on appeal.
Well...
If it's clear that the prosecutor's comments were improper, and what counsel should have done, normally I think the way these sorts of improper comments by prosecutors during the closing argument are handled is that you move for a mistrial or a curative instruction at the conclusion of the closing argument. And that wasn't done here either. And that wasn't argued on appeal. That would have been a pretty meritorious argument on appeal, wouldn't it?
The question under Strickland is whether it was unreasonable that no reasonable lawyer would have failed to make that argument. And I think that requires a comparison with what the appellate brief actually said. And I don't hear Carruth arguing that this argument was better than the rest of the arguments they had available, because appellate counsel has to be selective. You can't raise 100 different issues. You want to raise 2 or 3 or maybe 4. And so was it better than the other ones? I don't know. Carruth hasn't made that argument. Maybe this one line would have been a better argument, but he'd have to show that and then apply Strickland with AEDPA to show that no jurist could conclude that no reasonable lawyer would have failed to make that argument, or any jurist would conclude that any lawyer would make that argument. They're different phrasings, but it's a very high bar to show that he was constitutionally ineffective for failing to raise that on appeal. And counsel is not required to raise every single issue that there might be some support for in the record. And then finally, under Strickland, you've got to show prejudice. So would the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals agree with Carruth's argument and vacated the conviction based on that one line in the prosecutor's argument? And then if the state sought a petition of certiorari from the Alabama Supreme Court, would the Alabama Supreme Court have affirmed the reversal of that conviction? It's very speculative. And so not only is it unclear whether it was a constitutional violation from that one line, but to meet Strickland is an additional burden, additional barrier to federal habeas relief now. The third issue raised was about ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for failing to inform the client that the motion for rehearing was denied and to advise on further appellate options, so the availability of a cert petition to the Alabama Supreme Court. The state maintains that Carruth has not exhausted this argument either, because this argument was raised only in the context of getting that cert petition filed, excusing the untimeliness of that cert petition. In the original Rule 32 court where this argument was made, the remedy requested was to file an out-of-time cert petition, which it turned out the Rule 32 court didn't have power to do. That wasn't the proper procedure. But it was never an argument for a vacator of a conviction or the sentence. It was never an attack on the whole of the direct appeal. And so the state courts didn't have a chance to evaluate this argument as a collateral attack on the underlying conviction. And for that reason, it's unexhausted. But this court should reject relief on this claim for an additional reason, which is that Flores-Ortega is distinguishable. And I just heard counsel say that there's a circuit split on this issue of whether the requirement of trial counsel to notice appeal should be extended to a requirement of appellate counsel to advise on the third layer appellate review and advise on the availability of a cert petition. If there's a circuit split, then it's not clearly established federal law by the Supreme Court, and it can't be an unreasonable application of that law, which means that this claim fails under 2254D. Flores-Ortega, there may be good reason not to extend Flores-Ortega, which I believe the district court cited five different circuits that have refused exactly the argument that Carruth is making now, and only one that has granted it. And those reasons include the fact that review from the Alabama Supreme Court is discretionary, and so there's no right to effective assistance of counsel before the Alabama Supreme Court. And so the handoff between appellate counsel and potential Supreme Court counsel does not have to follow the same strictures that you would when you're handing off between two constitutionally guaranteed counsels. So what the court said in Flores-Ortega was that it wouldn't be much of a guarantee to have effective appellate counsel if the trial counsel did something that made that guarantee worthless by, for example, failing to file a notice of appeal. But we don't have that here because we don't have that higher level right in the Alabama Supreme Court to effective assistance. And so that's at least a reason that Flores-Ortega is distinguishable. And if it's not on all fours with this case, then it wasn't a violation of clearly established law when the state courts rejected this argument, if they even considered it in post-conviction proceedings.
But so even if Mr. Carruth is correct that we're looking at Alabama's, excuse me, Rule of Appellate Procedure 39, a violation of state law or procedure is not a basis for federal habeas relief, right?
I don't have it in front of me, but that's right. Right. So their argument relies on the fact that Alabama provides counsel for in capital punishment cases, but the fact that Alabama does not necessarily rise to the level of a constitutional right. And so for that reason, Flores-Ortega is distinguishable. This is still a Strickland claim, and Carruth still has to prove prejudice. And so I'm not sure I saw anywhere in the briefing where Carruth has shown here's what the cert petition would have included, and here's why the Alabama Supreme Court would have granted review and then reversed the conviction. What would have been argued in that cert petition? And we know there were only two arguments raised on appeal. There was a venue and a venue issue and a recusal issue. And Carruth has not argued that those were so meritorious that the Alabama Supreme Court would have reversed on those grounds. And so there's no prejudice from the inability to file a cert petition due to the alleged ineffectiveness. Carruth's counsel did not argue their fourth ground for relief on mitigation. If the court reaches this issue, the state maintains that this one was not exhausted either because it was not raised in the Court of Criminal Appeals or the Alabama Supreme Court. Carruth relies on a very narrow exception the Supreme Court adopted in Martinez versus Ryan. But Carruth has not shown that Martinez applies in Alabama, where multiple courts have said that it doesn't, because Martinez applies only where collateral proceedings are the first occasion to raise a Strickland claim. And in Alabama, you can raise a Strickland claim on direct appeal. And so the post-conviction proceeding is not the first opportunity, and so the exception does not apply. It also doesn't apply for another reason here, which is that the reason for the default of this claim was that it wasn't raised on appeal. But Carruth is arguing now that his Rule 32 counsel was ineffective for failing to develop mitigation evidence in Rule 32 court. All the mitigation was hearsay. Those are two different things. The reason for the default was it wasn't in the brief on appeal. That's different than the failure to develop evidence below. And so the cause for default was not the ineffectiveness at the trial level, and that's a predicate for the Martinez exception to apply. But even if the court applies Martinez to excuse the procedural default, there's just no there on mitigation. The mitigation evidence, which was proffered because it was excluded as hearsay in the state courts, shows that what Carruth told his counsel, that he had a good childhood and relatively normal upbringing, was basically true. And there wasn't much that could have been said to sway the jury, given the overwhelming evidence that Carruth had killed a 12-year-old boy. And
but didn't his counsel concede that his mitigation strategy was ineffective in accordance with Wiggins versus Smith?
Yes, his defense counsel did say that under Wiggins that he thought he should have done more. But the opinion, it may be admirable for a lawyer to admit his faults, but that admission has no legal effect because it's ultimately a question for this court as an objective matter under Strickland, was it objectively unreasonable? And he thought he could have done more, but the record...
Really do anything at all, did he?
Well, the record actually shows that he talked to his client, his client's mother, his client's son, and one of the brothers, and he was almost successful in getting three to testify at the trial, and then they backed out at the very last minute.
Were they subpoenaed?
No, they were not subpoenaed. But I think
that's another. That's more ineffectiveness.
Well, should the defense counsel force the family members who don't want to testify on in behalf of their brother or son who's accused of killing a child to go up there and say nice things about him? I think that would be a risky maneuver for counsel. And the proffered evidence from the mitigation investigator showed that the daughter was estranged from Carruth, that she didn't want any part of it and didn't have a good relationship with him. And forcing someone under threat of penalty to testify could have blown up in counsel's face. And so I don't think it's clear that that decision is unreasonable, and much less so that there was any prejudice from that decision, because we don't know what they would have said.
Is there any evidence before the state habeas court as to what evidence could have been discovered had counsel pursued mitigation further?
The only evidence in the state court was a statement by a mitigation investigator. And so none of the witnesses whom the investigator talked to actually testified in the Rule 32 proceedings. And so we don't know with any certainty what they would have said. We have only this hearsay evidence, which was excluded as inadmissible. And so this court can certainly look at that, but it should not be a ground for a habeas relief under AEDPA, because the question is what the state court record had at the time it made its decision, and that evidence was excluded under the Alabama Rules of Evidence against hearsay. And I haven't heard Carruth argue that the hearsay rules were fundamentally unfair or unconstitutional, or that decision was somehow improper or a basis for habeas relief. And of course, an attack on the state rule of evidence couldn't be a basis for habeas relief on its own. So all we have is this one statement. of what the witnesses said, and some of it is good, and it says that it's good in what it says about what they knew about Carruth when he was a child, and some of it is not so good about how he was an absent father and abandoned his daughter. And if the daughter had gotten up and testified, the prosecution would have elicited who knows what kind of things she might have said about Carruth. And if we have to guess like that, then it's not a ground for habeas relief, because the petitioner has the burden to prove under Strickland that every reasonable lawyer would have acted differently and it would have changed the outcome. And we just don't know, because that evidence was not sufficiently developed in the state courts to say with a certainty that there's a reasonable change in the outcome, particularly in light of the nature of this case. So even if Carruth had gotten in that evidence about that as a child he had extracurricular activities like Future Farmers of America, it would not have mattered because there's overwhelming evidence of guilt, which is not in question here. And there are four statutory aggravators, that this was capital murder during a burglary, during a robbery, during a kidnapping, and that it was heinous, atrocious, and cruel. And the jury came back with a unanimous verdict. I don't think there was anything in that the family members could have said to change the jury's mind, which the record at trial amply supported the verdict. I started with prejudice, and I'll end with prejudice for any of these claims, whether it was the jurors passing remarks over a game of Rummy Cube or the prosecutor's one line about the penalties, which he quickly corrected, or the failure to advise about a cert petition possibility, or the failure to talk about Carruth's normal childhood. None of these alleged errors would have made any difference in this case. This was a lawful conviction for a heinous and atrocious murder of a 12-year-old boy. And under Alabama law, that sentence warrants death. That's what the jury did. And this court should not grant relief disturbing that moral judgment of the state and the people.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Goggins, you reserve some time for rebuttal.
First in rebuttal, I want to talk just a little bit about whether there was a waiver of the argument about appellate counsel not having raised anything on direct appeal about the prosecutor's comment about punishment. If one of the hardest parts of my practice is reading my own handwriting, but if you look at some of the briefs that were filed on appeal in the post-conviction, in document 2135, says prosecution argued for the jury to consider the potential punishment as justification for a guilt phase verdict. And then also there's a lot of back and forth of referencing, if you look at paragraph whatever or section whatever. Certainly it could have flowed much better, but there is reference back and forth. And then the brief also said, paragraph 78 to 81, if Carruth's petition alleged ineffective assistance of appellate counsel based on failure to mention issues on direct appeal, in particular issues set forth in claims, and then it lists a whole lot of claims, one of which was the improper argument of counsel during the guilt phase argument. So I think that, although not as artfully done as could have been done, it was included in the appellate briefs. Turning back to the juror talking about the case before they had been instructed and sent into the jury room for final deliberations. when Juror CT was questioned, she was asked if she said if we ever discussed it, it was in the break room during trial. We never communicated when we went back to the hotel. She was asked a follow-up. Is it your testimony today that during the course of the trial, while the jury was on breaks and in the jury room, evidence was discussed while you were a member of a jury? Answer, yes. Juror Horn, who signed the statement beforehand, had, well, it's the trial judge, the state court trial judge at the Rule 32 said it was admitted for impeachment purposes. It probably could have also been used for a fresh recollection. But one of the reasons for impeachment evidence is shows like, look, what this person said is not exactly accurate. Initially, Juror J.H. says, well, we might have mentioned a piece of evidence here and there. We might have talked about, you know, we're shocked by this, that, or the other. I don't really recall whether he's innocent or guilty. It's been a good while back. But he had signed this statement. It's not just a quick statement typed up, signed at the bottom of it. It was a handwritten statement that he went through. He said he read it. He went through it. Word for made like 40-something corrections and initialed each correction. The man read the statement carefully, or he wouldn't have made all those corrections on it. Granted, it's not admitted as substantive evidence, but I think that we can clearly look at that and say, look, they talk about the evidence. Everybody knows they did. The guy said that before. He knows they talked about the evidence. They talked about the evidence, and they went further than just saying, hey, you know, that witness was on for a long time, or, wow, that was a rough picture we had to look at. Turning to the handoff again after criminal appeals had ruled on the case, the Flores-Ortega case essentially says, look, if a reasonable person in this defendant's position would want to appeal, like, hey, there really is an issue here that maybe want to take up, or whether there's an issue or not, whether the defendant says, hey, I want to appeal. Lawyers got to talk with them about it, and if they want to appeal, the appeal's got to be filed. In this case, the state has granted a person sentenced to death something beyond the criminal appeals ruling. It says, look, if there's a death penalty, the cert petition has to be filed by counsel. Now, what happens after that, we don't know.
But can a violation of state law or procedure serve as a basis for federal habeas relief?
Broadly speaking, I don't think I can say just a procedural rule in and of itself would support a habeas petition. However, I think where the state has granted someone a right, that right has to have some meaning. For example, in this case, you don't get all the way through, but you at least get to the point of saying, hey, this is death sentence defendants, you have a right to have a lawyer file a cert petition for you. It's got to be done. First of all, that's required under the state rules and laws. Second of all, I mean, obviously you're in a position, you know, if you've got somebody, they got probation, everybody was thinking they would get 10 years, you would think that person would want to, you know, go off and appeal on a guilty plea. But here you have someone sentenced to death. There's absolutely no way you can think that a reasonable person in that situation would not want to go further. And in the Flores-Ortega case is essentially saying, look, by the lawyer not doing this, the lawyer has essentially deprived this defendant of the appeal completely. There's just like no counsel at all. And I think that's what we have here. There's no counsel at all for the cert petition. Quickly on the Martinez argument on the mitigation witnesses, the way I think Martinez applies here is that we're talking about there's an allegation in Rule 32 proceedings that trial counsel was ineffective because subpoena people, have them on the witness stand. I don't think it's a situation where the record reflects it's a situation where the counsel has said, and I've talked with these people, it's kind of dicey to put them on. I don't think I'm going to call them.
He thought he had made adequate arrangements for them to be there, but he had not. So they're not there. So apparently the record shows there were plans to put on some evidence. He just didn't. The problem in the Rule 32 proceeding is that counsel in the Rule 32 proceeding was apparently unaware that, no, you've actually got to have a live witness here. You just can't have a written statement and affidavit where somebody come in and say, hey, here's what they told me. While that might be okay in the original proceeding, that's not allowed in the Rule 32. And as far as the question, like, you know, they don't show up. That's what a subpoena is for. You know, in my experience, a lot of times when somebody's pleading guilty, the trial judge going through the rights with the defendant's going to say, you understand you have a right to have witnesses testify on your behalf. If they don't want to show up, if they don't show up and you get them subpoenaed, we'll send the sheriff out to go get them. That wasn't done here. As far as getting witnesses there to testify in the penalty phase of the trial. I think that's it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you.
All right.
Court is adjourned.